You're listening to the Bliss Runner Podcast, episode number 18.
I don't care if nobody wants to hear it. Everybody has to hear it. The only way this is going to stop is when everybody knows the harm of circumcision and when they do it'll end. So I'm going to keep on talking.
This podcast is for any woman who has ever had a challenge in her sex life. Whether you've lost interest in sex in your long-term relationship, orgasms have become elusive, or you've just been longing for something more, something deeper that you can't quite even articulate, this podcast is here to help. In this show, we'll explore how you can transform your experience of sex by learning the subtle art of awakening your sexual energy. Now, this is not just woo-woo stuff. It's tangible, and it's having a profound effect on women's lives. We'll hear stories by women like you and me who've moved from lack of sexual enjoyment to incredible, expanded, ecstatic states by accessing this energy inside. We'll also talk to authors, teachers, and practitioners in the field for guidance on how you can get started on this deeply gratifying journey. I can tell you that it has completely changed my life, and I know it can enrich yours. I'm really glad you're here. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Bliss Runner Podcast. This is part two of my interview with Marilyn Milos. Marilyn is the executive director of Genital Autonomy America, and she is basically the founding mother of the Intactivist movement. That movement fights to try and stop surgically altering babies when they're born, whether boys or girls or intersex, and Marilyn has been leading the pack for almost 40 years. In part one of my interview with Marilyn, she shares with us how she became involved in this movement, and she educates us about what circumcision is, specifically with regard to male circumcision, and she tells us why it's not necessary. In this episode, we're going to get into the ramifications of this practice on both parties' experience of sexuality, both the person who is circumcised as well as their partner. In addition, she's going to talk to us about the psychological ramifications of the procedure and some of the effects on society at large. So let's get right back into this conversation with Marilyn.
Let's talk about some of the side effects of circumcision on the sexual experience, both of the man and of the woman. And, you know, it seems counterintuitive that it's possible both to have lost the most sensitive part and then also be so sensitive that premature ejaculation is an issue. So talk us through how, you know, the mechanics so that we understand it more fully.
As I mentioned, encircling the opening of the foreskin are somewhere between 20,000 and 70,000 nerve endings, specialized erogenous nerve endings. If you want to know what they feel like, just with your fingernails, gently rub along the back of your hand or your arm and register what that feels like. What you're rubbing, when you rub the epiderma like that, you're feeling Pacinian corpuscles. They feel deep pressure and pain, and you have to have a good rub you kind of get it. You know something's there, but okay. So now turn your hand over and very, very gently stimulate, just rub along the palm of your hand. Mm-hmm. You feel this difference in sensation?
Yeah.
One man said, gee, that part tickles. And I said, I told him about a little 5-year-old when, little boys in the back seat of the car, mom is carpooling, and one of them mentioned circumcision, and, her son asked, what is that? And so mom tells him, he said, oh, mom, I'm so glad you didn't let anybody cut off that part. That's the part that tickles the best. So these miser corpuscles encircle the opening of the foreskin, and these are the nerve endings that let a man know what his penis is feeling and where he is in relationship to the orgasmic threshold. One of the things I'm work really hard with circumcised men is to, when I say this to them, I always say, fortunately, pleasure is pleasure, and you have some pleasure because obviously they do. It feels good. but it doesn't feel as good as it was supposed to feel, and that's what, and nor as normal. So what happens is the man with a foreskin rides the wave to orgasm the same way a woman does. He has multiple little orgasms along the way, as women often do, to the big bang. Yeah. It's the same. It's the same kind of, and it's a full body experience for the man who has been circumcised. All those nerve endings are gone, so he gets the pleasure because there are still some nerve endings in the glands in the head of the penis. However, when the glands is denuded by the amputation of the foreskin, and now is rubbing against underwear all day long, it becomes callous, which means those nerve endings that are on the head of the penis, nothing like in the foreskin, but there are some, and the head of the penis become buried, and they. Under the callousing. Mm-hmm. So this is why over the years there's less and less sensitivity, along with aging, of course, it's part of it, but that's, and so when the man then goes to have sex, it's oops, honey, and there's no way to know where that trigger is. They're just triggered. So up they go and then off the cliff. It's not that glide up and the glide down and the same. Yeah. So, and in terms of for the female, when the man with intercourse, the labia and the foreskin come together, and the labia sort of help the foreskin push back as the glands then enters the vagina, and as the foreskin is exposed, the inner lining of the foreskin is exposed. All of those nerve endings are exposed. They come in contact with the vagina and then the inward and outward. And of course, with the extra flesh of the foreskin, you've got some width that, or girth that you wouldn't have had, with a circumcised male. Mm-hmm. You can't cut something off and have more. But that gliding mechanism, and the foreskin is also the gliding mechanism for masturbation. How would you rub your eyeball without using your eyelid? Impossible.
Right.
So, well, it's not impossible, but you better use a lubrication. Coconut oil is what I say for sex. But, you know, you have to have something there because it's too, otherwise it feels like a woman's being penetrated by a dry dowel. And that's not pleasant.
Right. Yes. So some of the big issues for women, and I'll speak from experience on this, is dryness. So quickly losing natural lubrication and needing to use supplementary lubrication with a circumcised man.
That's right. And Susanna, the reason for that is because with every outward stroke, the corona, which is the wide part, the crown of the glands, the head part, flares out, drags all the vaginal juices out, so they end up in external environment, on the legs or the areas around.
Yeah.
And so she's dry, and he's added nothing to the equation. So whereas an intact man has his juices too.
Right.
So yes, number one, that's you've noticed good. The other thing that I've learned with a lot of women and myself as well is that being on top works because the what the movements that a man and a male needs and they both need are not really compatible. So if a woman can be on top, then she can kind of control what she needs, so she can get what she needs. And hopefully he's getting it as well, you know. But that's helped. That seems to help for both, because otherwise what she needs is not working.
Right.
Isn't getting delivered.
Isn't being met. Yeah. So, yeah. And then another big issue is friction. And that
that's without lubrication, you got friction.
Yeah. Or even with it, it's a different mechanism. Like you described, the foreskin glides back and forth on the shaft of the penis and protects, is like a buffer between the penis and the walls of the vagina, so the vagina doesn't have to endure as much friction. And we all think that friction is the thing. Like we think, oh, that's the good part, right? But it's actually, I think, the reason for the epidemic of women who do not experience pleasure in their vaginas during intercourse. It's just
that's
too much friction.
This is a huge issue with couples, and nobody knows why. That's
right.
I've written about this. I wrote an article about this. It's just this is something that nobody discusses, and you have to. You have to bring up this discussion. You have to start talking about it, because when you love somebody who's circumcised, are you going to leave them to find an intact? No, you're not.
No,
you know,
right.
So you have to figure out what works and what doesn't, because otherwise you're both miserable.
Yep.
And you have to talk about it to figure out how you're going to make this work. And the horror is that you have to, because some doctor did that and charged your mother for it.
Right. So let's see. Have we left out any of the ill effects here? I'm sure we have. Friction. I know one thing. That is related to friction. During the circumcision procedure, is it possible that that skin from the pubic area where there would be pubic hair ends up being drawn up onto the shaft? Like, I've had many partners.
An aggressive circumciser has taken weight. The skin of the foreskin, the foreskin is the skin that's necessary for a full erection and a comfortable erection.
Mm-hmm.
And without that, you've got to have the skin. The corpus cavernosa are going to fill up with blood with erection. When stimulated, they're going to fill with blood, and it's going to pull. And many men complain of the pain of tight erections. And mm-hmm. throughout childhood, you see little boys squirming, unable to leave their penises alone because they hurt. The circumcision has been so tight. They've left so little skin. When my third son was born, and you know my story, how the horror of having had my own three sons circumcised and not recognizing between the first one and the last that something was wrong. I just didn't get it. And you wonder how could I possibly have had such a huge blind spot, one that would affect me and my children for the rest of our lives, you know?
Mm.
And yet there it is. But with my last son, and this is almost an embarrassing story to talk about, because I still didn't know what circumcision was. So when I took my son, and I'm still thinking it doesn't hurt, that's what I'd heard. So when for my 6-week checkup after my third son was born, this was with my second husband, who was a circumcised man and wanted his son. He said, "I think a circumcised penis looks better."
Mm-hmm.
So I said, "Yes, we're going to have them circumcised." Well, they left a little cuff of skin. And when I took him back, my husband said, "Oh, ask him to take that little cuff off, because he didn't do it right. He didn't make it the way it's supposed to look." I see he has this idea in his mind of what the hell is it supposed to look like? You know, who are we to say what somebody else's penis is supposed to look like, where that scar is supposed to be? I mean, that when you realize that we're talking about where the scar is supposed to be, it's really a grotesque discussion, isn't it?
Mm.
At any rate, I took it back and one, you know, after I witnessed the circumcision, I had to go back to all those moments in my life when my first husband said that, when the doctor said that, when I brought my first son home, when I still didn't recognize it with two more boys, and then taking this last baby back to say, "Could you cut off a little more?" And the doctor took a step back, and I didn't know why he took a step back. I got that I felt repugnant when he took a step back, but I didn't know what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
I still didn't know what I was even asking. He said, "Well, this is why I tell the story is because the importance of the power of the doctor." I said to the doctor, he wants his father wants to have a little more taken off here, and he said, "Oh, this is how we do it now because it leaves it a little more relaxed for the erection." I went home and told that to my husband, and he said, "Oh, okay." We both agree, you know, whatever the doctor said, that was it. So,
right.
Which is why, by the way, I went to the American Academy of Pediatrics and had I had a booth there for probably 15 years, and which is about $5,000 at every convention, to travel there, to stay in a hotel, to have all my equipment shipped there and have printing done and all that, and get there. And mostly it was foreign doctors. And I probably the best work I did there was with Hispanic doctors who were forcibly retracting the foreskin prematurely. And they understood to leave it alone and why.
Mm-hmm.
And they went back to their country and began doing that. And kept coming back year after year telling me that this was so much better, and they were telling all their colleagues. So we made a difference there. But in terms of American doctors, rarely did they come to the booth. And I had a picture of a little naked baby once, and some doctor comes by the booth, and he said, "My wife thinks that's obscene. A a child's body, a little baby's body is obscene? And he said, well, actually, it upsets me too. And I said, how can you be a pediatrician and think that a child's body is obscene? It was so amazing to me. But, well, the boy had a foreskin, so maybe that has. But at any rate, you can't appeal to the doctors to for this. You know, we have to get parents. We have to educate. We have to educate the population. Doctors will change, but they're not the first ones to change. Especially, remember, there's a financial incentive here.
Yeah.
They have a personal preference, a culture preference, perhaps a religious preference, and a financial incentive. So you don't go to the stakeholders to change. You go to the, you know, so it took me a long time to learn that.
Yeah.
And, you know, somebody said to me, Marilyn, why you? We were in Italy, and we were having dinner before the night of a symposium that I was having at the University of Padua. And the co-sponsor is a psychologist there. And it was her husband who asked me. He said, Marilyn, why you? And I said, I heard the scream of the baby. He said, do you know how many millions of people have heard that scream? And I said, well, why not them?
Yeah.
I mean, and I thought that, why didn't anybody else? Why hasn't anybody else? That was a thing that got me. How could you watch a baby being tortured and mutilated and not want to jump in? The scream alerts your brain to something is horribly, horribly wrong. Mm-hmm. And your heart tells you, you need to help.
Right.
And
right.
I did, you know.
Well, but to sustain that for how many years now? Sam, when did you first?
38. It'll be 39 years next year, and I'm going to do my 15th symposium because I started when I was 39 years old in 1979, and next year I'll be 39 years old, so half my life.
Mm.
I was just going to say to you, Dean Adel had two guests on his show. One was Hillary Clinton and one was me. And it was when in 1989, when the AAP came out and said circumcision wasn't necessary, he said, you've never wavered, have you, Marilyn? I said, you know, when you're right, why would you ever waver? After I witnessed the circumcision, I was traumatized. I was in shock and horror, and I came home and told my kids I told my family at the dinner table what I witnessed, because I was still from that place of shock without realizing. I was telling my sons and my husband what had happened to them when they were too little to consent, resist, or escape, you know. So there was that. But in those early days, I was telling everybody I couldn't not. I just was so traumatized. And then after a little while, I realized that everybody's backing up. They don't want to hear it. I'm not being invited to birthday parties and so forth. I'm thinking, this is a message nobody wants to hear. And one day I was leaving the hospital as the baby is being circumcised. And usually they waited till I'd gone because I couldn't stand the screams. They knew I'd start crying immediately.
Yeah.
And so I was running down the stairs, and then I'm hearing the scream, and I'm thinking, I've got to stop this, but this is a message nobody wants to hear. And I spent the whole day crying. I was so distraught. And by the end of the day, I had my head on my desk, and I picked it up off my desk, and I just said, I don't care if nobody wants to hear it. Everybody has to hear it. The only way this is going to stop is when everybody knows the harm of circumcision, and when they do, it'll end. So I'm going to keep on talking.
Good.
And I have, you know, I have.
Let's talk a little bit about how we can move through the resistance and the defensiveness. When I'd become pregnant, I didn't know what I was having, but I already knew, thanks to your appearance on the Phil Donahue show, that I was not going to circumcise my child if it was a boy. And I was being active on some pregnancy forums on the internet. This was in the early 2000s, and the topic of circumcision was always the most hotly debated topic on this forum. It was so intense. People would attack each other, and I remember
terrible.
Especially the women who were insisting on circumcision being the most aggressive about their position. And I just, you know, it was very upsetting. It was very hard to be a part of those conversations. And so I just would bow out because I just didn't feel like I could say anything that would get beyond that resistance. And so what are some of the things that do seem to land?
Well, this goes back to what I mentioned to you, Gandhi's quote, which has been so helpful to me. First they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they fight you, then they win. Then you win. So what I do, I mean, one of the things that has helped me through is because people do have resistance. I told you the story about myself, about people, you know, not, I'm sticking my head above the horizon and nobody wanting to hear this. And pretty soon people not inviting me to birthday parties or to celebrations or, you know, to weddings or to whatever, because, and I learned to keep my mouth shut about it because, but by then everybody knew what I brought out of from behind closed doors, and others would talk about it. So now people invite me and they're proud of me, but it wasn't like that initially. So when people, I just look to see how they're reacting to what I'm saying, and I can kind of fit them into what Gandhi had to say. Are they ignoring me? Are they laughing at me? Are they resisting me? Did I win yet? And some people, let me say it this way. Around the time I did my second symposium, 1991, there was a man, Dr. Tom Ritter, who had been trying to publish a book. Now it's called Doctors Reexamine Circumcision, I think. But it's been rewritten with George Dennison, and Tom has since died. But he wrote this book, and he was trying to get a publisher. And he couldn't get any big publishers, so there was a guy in California who was sort of interested, and that man, Ken Albert, who was a publisher, came to my symposium, my second symposium. This was 1991, and Tom Ritter spoke at that symposium, and he also had sent this publisher something about his book. And at that symposium also, Jim Bigelow spoke, and he talked about foreskin restoration, the joy of uncircumcision. He was speaking about foreskin restoration. And Ken decided after that symposium to publish both of these men's books, and did. But he said to me, you know, Marilyn, I listened to Dr. Dean Adell on the air for 6 years, and I always wondered why he was always talking about circumcision, and I heard you call in, and I always hear you guys, and I'm just thinking, why is he crazy or what? And he said, but one day, I don't know, I heard him again, and I went, aha, I get it. And then he came to the symposium, and he got it bigger, and then he did it. So he listened for 6 years. What
was it? Rights aspect, do you think? What was it that he got?
He just got that this was not a good thing to do to babies, and I don't know. You know, that's a good thing that I should have asked. I mean, he just got the issue is what he was saying to me, and I just took it at that. It's interesting. I should have asked him exactly what it was. I think it was probably the accumulation of it all. He could no longer live in denial. It just sort of came to him that they're right. And he'd heard so much already, and Dean talked about it from every aspect, you know, whether it was cultural, religious aspect, or the medical aspect, or on and on, or the harm documentation, and so forth. And we did. Dean donated money to NoCirc when this Semi Weinstein monofilament test came out. We tested the sensitivity. He said, when you test the sensitivity of the foreskin as compared to the rest of the penis, people will get it. So we did, and we published it British Journal of Urology. BJU International. British Journal of Urology. Nobody else would take our thing. We couldn't get it into an American publication. Into an American journal. The New England Journal of Medicine and the two journals of urology refused to take it, but it was published in the British Journal of Urology. And it talked about the sensitivities and so forth. Interesting, and that the foreskin is the most sensitive part of the penis. Interestingly, three or four other studies have come out now trying to refute ours. And in one, they studied the shaft of the penis. They tested the shaft of the penis and the arm to see if people were, if their bodies were reacting to, I don't know what it was, but, so they tested the arm and the penis. They didn't test the foreskin because the circumcised men didn't have one, so that it would be unfair to test theirs to see if it was more sensitive or not. So how could you test it? How could you test a normal penis if you don't test the foreskin? You know?
Yeah. Well,
why we did the study was to show that the foreskin is more sensitive. So anyway, so Dean did that, but he addressed this from every aspect, and Ken, I think, finally got it. So when you're dealing with the sensitivity of people, for me, and I talked to a lot of antactivists about this because, they get, depressed and so forth. I said, when people first hear this message, if you start talking to them, you're knocking on their door. Perhaps it's the first time anybody has knocked on that door. Mm-hmm. One day they'll open the door. It will be opened. But all you've done is they've heard the door, or you let a little light in, and next time a little more light will come in. It may not be the first time or the 45th time, but one day or another, because we have right on our side, we are right. So truth and right will win one day.
Yeah.
I don't know when. So I think we just have to give people space to assimilate this information that they can't. What man wants to hear that he was strapped down in the most sensitive part of his body, was amputated without his consent when he was too little to consent, resist, or escape, mm-hmm. and that his sex life has been altered for his entire life because of it, and that it would have been better had he not been circumcised? What man wants to hear that? What mother wants to hear that her baby suffered needlessly? You know, that,
right.
That's most grievous thing you could possibly live with. And I said this, to Neil Bernard, who heads Physicians for Responsible Medicine. I said to him, he asked why is this taking so long? And I'm saying these same things to him. And I said, and what doctor once he has admit he's got blood on his hands? And Neil, who's a psychiatrist and doesn't do circumcisions for a living, but I'll bet he did one during medical school, because I said, what doctor once with me, he's got blood on his hands because he put his hands behind his back. Mm. And I said, he's a psychiatrist. Talk about body language.
Yeah. Yeah.
to be patient. I'm learning patience in this. I'm not a patient person, but the only hard part of that is that while we're having to be patient, babies are having to suffer, you know.
I can't stand it. So
me either.
What is the number one?
That's the right reaction, darling.
Well, I'll tell you, it was so extreme for me that, so I actually, with my baby's father, we had quite an argument about this. So we didn't know what we were going to have, but he had been circumcised, and, you know, around about the fifth or sixth month, I had talked about this many times, but we brought it up specifically, and I reiterated that I felt very, very strongly that that it wasn't necessary and blah, blah, blah. And
no way.
he said, I really think I want to do it. I want my son to look like me. And it
so if you have a scar, if you have a tattoo, is he going to get, are you tattoo him? If you're bald, are you going to, cut off his hair? I know.
Well, of course, as you can imagine, I brought out all kinds of those kind of remarks, and I got very, very upset and very, in my mind was thinking, if he insists on maintaining this position, because I'm going to be the one in the hospital who's probably, unable to advocate for my baby, because I will have just given birth, and he'll be the one. If he's pushing for it, you know, would I have the power to prevent
it? I hear you.
I was like, I will walk away from this relationship before I will allow this baby to be circumcised. So that's how strongly I felt about it.
Bravo, mama.
well, you know, it's scary, but much to his credit, he eventually came around. So,
but you got it right, because if we don't see. And here's why you got it right. What circumcision does is, first of all, it interferes between – it interferes. It doesn't undo because or deny the mother-infant bond. That's there. That begins from inception onward, conception onward. But it does alter the maternal-infant bond. It disrupts it. But also – the baby's first developmental task is to establish trust, and it's mother's responsibility to ensure that the baby trusts. That means you love and you hold and you protect your baby and you keep it safe. And when you serve your baby up to the circumciser's platter, that baby, you have betrayed your child. Mm-hmm. So the baby always perceives this, and a Jewish psychiatrist only had one child because it was a boy, and she couldn't relinquish at that point in her life, was unable to relinquish her religion and couldn't stand to have any more children. She wanted a large family, but wouldn't, because she couldn't stand the thought of having to, another child having to endure this, you know. Mm-hmm. So, but she said circumcision is always perceived by the baby as betrayal by the mother. So the mother's job is to protect her baby, even if it's from a circumcised man who wants to pass the wounding along. And if you want to know how circumcision affects a human being, all you have to do is listen to the man who wants, circumcised man who wants his son to go through, endure that same wounding so that he'll look like him. Mm. That's what, you know, you get it.
So
bravo, mama.
Let's talk a little bit about there are more and more men who have been circumcised who are coming to the realization of what has been done to them and grieving it and going through the process sometimes of attempting to restore their foreskin. Can you talk a little bit about that healing process? And
yes, what I see from foreskin restoration, initially the men who wanted to do this was in the early 80s. You know, I think, first of all, let's start, I'll give you the sort of background here, is a lot of gay men lived in San Francisco, as you know, during the 80s, mm-hmm. 70s and 80s. And they were the first ones who were, they'd come out of the closet. They were liberated. And they were enjoying, sadly, they were enjoying their freedom, because that was before anybody knew about AIDS. Right. And that cost a lot of lives. But they were the ones who were finally being who they were. I mean, they got crazy. They were rebelling and rejoicing and having a good time doing it. And they got into trouble with that. Nevertheless, they were looking at each other's penises, and they were the ones who got to see the extensive scars, the hunks and slices that were missing, the curvatures, the complaining to each other about what had been lost, or the pain, or the tight erections, or on and on and on. Mm-hmm. They talked. And in that talking, they were the ones who began to think about, what about restoring? What if you could get your foreskin back? Because they also were seeing men who were intact and recognizing that they weren't having these complications or pain, or they didn't have the results of the harm of what circumcision had left upon their bodies. So they began to think about foreskin restoration. And they started going to a Dr. Donald Greer, actually. New Mexico or Arizona, one of those states. And he started doing foreskin reconstructions. He developed a specific technique, which was a long, laborious. So I think it was three different surgeries to do this. And the first thing that he did was make the fellows who wanted to have foreskin rest and wanted their foreskins back go to a psychiatrist. John Erickson and I, he was an early worker, and laughed at that. You know, the people who should be whose heads need to be examined are the circumcisers, not the people who want their foreskin back.
Exactly.
Nobody laughs at a woman who wants a breast back after breast reconstruction, after cancer surgery. It was traumatic. We don't laugh at women for this, but they laughed at men, and men, they were still laughing. Well, what happened then with those early surgeries, which were extensive and time consuming and certainly not perfect. And some of those early surgeries, there's a man came over here from England who had reconstructive surgery there, and he came back and his penis looked like a sausage, just a mutilated sausage. It was just like a chewed up hunk of. So imagine, here's a man who has recognized the harm of what's been done to him, is so troubled by what's been done to him, wants to fix it, and goes to and is willing to go back to another doctor after it was a doctor who did this to him, is going back to another doctor to have it fixed. Well, and what happened, of course, is that some of them turned out awful, and these men became even more, mentally disturbed by what had happened. And, of course, many of them so depressed, and there were some suicides that followed. Mm. So men then began to use skin stretching techniques. And what I've seen with it, they're tedious, time-consuming, but they work. Anybody can Google foreskin restoration, and you can find these gentle stretching devices. Mm-hmm. And it should always be gentle. Anytime you feel pain, you're causing harm, and that's not what you want. And the men know this, and they've come a long way with this stuff. Lots of engineers on board making devices and so forth to help men. But what I see what happens when a man regains his foreskin, stretches it again. Here's what happens. Well, first of all, is how it works is when you put tension on tissue, and pull it apart, new cells form in the spaces that were created by that tension. And you know, skin stretches, all you have to do is look at a pregnant woman and it's evident, right?
Right. So, or the earlobes of someone who's worn discs in their earlobes. Yeah.
Right. Or just me now at 77 years old, with long earlobes where I probably had none initially from wearing earrings, you know?
Right.
So we know skin stretches, and that's what men have capitalized on it. And two things happen. One is they've taken back their power of their own bodies. It was their body, and someone did something to it that they don't like. They've got their power back. I've got my body. I have a foreskin. When that man goes into the doctor's office, and the doctor says, "Oh, I see you're not circumcised." I cannot tell you how many times men have said to me, "I came out of it, I was screaming, just I'm so happy." Mm. You know, okay, that's empowerment. I have a whole body again. And they know they'll never get back all those nerve endings. They know that they suffered the trauma and the indignation and so forth. But still, it's the best. They get what they can, and they do. And that's really wholesome. And the other part is, you know, they're feeling empowered by that, I think.
Are they able to stretch the skin enough so that their skin comes down over the glands again?
Yep.
Or, oh, wow.
Yep. Yep.
Wow.
Yep.
I just always imagined that it was just that they were getting enough skin that there'd be more, you know, room for growth and play, I guess.
That's what my husband did. And he wasn't greedy about it, you know. one man called. He said, "You know, I am getting greedy." He said, I was without a foreskin for many, many years. I think he's 35 or 40, with many, many years, and now I've got one. And he said, "And I just want to keep going." And he said, "How do I know when I've got enough or when it's too much?" I said, "Are you tripping over it yet?" He said, "No." I said, "Well, then you haven't got too much." So, you know.
Yeah. How long does it take?
Well, it can take up to 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but often I think the least I've heard is a year and a half. It depends on the kind of tissue a person has, how tight the cut is, how determined the man is. You know, because it's tedious, it's time consuming, it takes tape and so forth. And initially, and one man started where he just used a Band-Aid. He said, "I put a Band-Aid," because little boys who've been circumcised, you see them in the bathtub. My kids did this. It's always sticking the glands inside and pulling over. And I never understood what that was until my husband said, "When I was a little boy, I'd stick my glands inside myself and hold it, knowing I felt normal. It felt like that's how it was supposed to be."
Mm-hmm.
I didn't recognize that, but that's what my sons were doing, because I was still in the dark until, you know, I witnessed a circumcision for the first time when my sons were 10, 17, and 20.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then having to go back and look at the horror. Okay, well, I don't want to revisit that.
Yeah. Well, it's great to know that some creative individuals out there came up with this technique that is giving men some psychological healing as well as, you know, physical healing.
The other part is, the psychological number one, and the physical part is no longer the abrasion.
Right.
The glands, the first thing that happens that every man talks about is the glands start sloughing the tissue. The callousing goes away.
Mm-hmm.
So they have increased sensitivity as well. So men who are almost impotent at age 50, at 65, are having a sex life again. So this is not a bad, I mean, it's the best you can do. You're making lemonade, you know?
Yeah, right. And I'm sure.
But thank heavens. For me, that was it was when I learned about foreskin restoration, because otherwise, what do you have to tell a man? I mean, it's pretty awful.
Yeah.
What's been done to them, and how do they live with it? Or a woman too, and there are reconstructive surgeries for women as well now, and probably for the intersex as well. Although I'm not familiar with that, I'm just getting more and more into that, into the aspect of what they've suffered. Because Ida was beautiful at the symposium when she put her hands up in the air that they're trying to get rid of, and she said, you know, but well, just that. up until now, they've been trying to annihilate that gender. And what's happening now is California, Oregon, and Washington, D.C. have a check, a little box that you can check other on the birth certificates and driver's license.
Oh, that's marvelous.
And Dana Zim, who served in the military and came out recognizing that he was intersex, and now lives as an intersex human being, Dana Zim, was denied a passport because she wouldn't fill in male or female. He had lived as male and female. They now call themselves they because she's both male and female and has chosen the they pronouns for their self. Their selves. It's difficult.
It is cumbersome. We need to probably come up with a brand new pronoun.
Well, in some societies, the people who are intersex have been revered because they're not sitting on one side of the great gender divide. Mm-hmm. They're embracing both. They have qualities of both, and they were revered because they included both aspects, which is the whole.
Right. Well, I mean, spiritually speaking, so many of us spend years and years trying to balance our male and female energies, right, so that we can be unified and whole. And
yes.
Here
yes,
are people yes. who are born that way. And yes. we try and change it. It's terrible.
Right. And try to eliminate that gender when it shouldn't be. When it's the other. It's the other gender.
Yeah.
The idea is changing consciousness. And none of these things are easy. But my golly, it's a whole lot easier to change consciousness than it is to keep on mutilating the bodies of children. And by the way, when you talk about what happens to babies, what is it that we're doing to our children? I don't know if you know the work of Gabor Maté. He's a brilliant, brilliant man.
I don't.
He wrote a book called In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts, and I suggest that everybody on this planet should read it. He's talking about addictions. He was working with drug addicts in Vancouver, Canada, and what he says is that when an infant or a child suffers pain and trauma, the first thing you've done, if you inflict this on the child, that child becomes vulnerable. You've made that child vulnerable. He's always waiting for the other shoe to drop. And that vulnerability will continue through life.
Sort of like viewing the universe as a scary place rather than a benevolent place.
That's exactly right. And then the second part of that is the child learns helplessness. Michelle O'Donnell spoke about that at my second symposium and maybe my third or fourth. But talked about learned helplessness, which is, when that child is struggling so desperately to get why the babies come back with bruises on their arms and legs after a circumcision, they're fighting with all their might to get away, mm-hmm. and they can't get anywhere. Learned helplessness. That's what happens. Nothing I can do about it. It's the deer in headlights. Oh, throw my hands up in the air and say, there's nothing I can do, because that was the earliest primal experience. Mm-hmm. And then the final thing is, because it is the child who is the center of his own universe, he believes that he not only that the pain that he's experiencing is not only his caused by him, it's self-inflicted. He's not only the cause of the pain, he's suffering the pain as well.
Mm-hmm.
It's very, very complicated, but that's what we're doing to our children when we do this. I have a poem that Suzanne Arms wrote, and she says, if we hope to create a nonviolent world where respect and kindness replace fear and hatred, we must begin with how we treat each other at the beginning of life. For that is where our deepest patterns are set. From these roots grow fear and alienation, or love and trust. And it's exactly what you said. Either we help our children not only to survive, but to thrive. And when we welcome them into a warm world of love, respect, and protection, they blossom like a flower. They open up. When they're met with pain, with trauma, with a bottle fed, cried out, circumcision, spankings, and so forth, they contract inward. And so that's the fear. So it's either love or fear. And we create in each child at the very beginning of life. So, throughout those early years of childhood. So it's important for us to learn not to do these harmful things to our children, isn't it?
Yes. Well, I can't help at this time where, you know, every other day it seems there's a revelation about someone sexually abusing, you know, numerous women. I can't help wondering whether there's a connection between that kind of effect on an infant and the way they view women or treat women later in life.
How could there not be, Susanna? How could there not be? Carl Menninger said, what is done to children, they will do to society. And Gandhi said, if we're ever to have real peace, we must begin with the children.
I am feeling hopeful because I know that you haven't won the fight yet, but that the numbers have gone down as far as they have.
It is the most sensitive part of the male body, and it affects, when it's cut off, it affects it all, us all. What we do to children is done to society. Look at the Middle East. Who's there? The Jews, the Muslims, and the North Americans. There's not a normal penis on that battlefield.
Yeah.
Now that's not the only excuse for wars or for doing bad things. But when you have rage and anger inside because somebody has assaulted your body in the primal period, not everybody's going to come out fighting, but some will, and we can end it. We can bring that. And you know, if you knew which ones would end up being violent because they were circumcised, then we could maybe say, well, we just won't circumcise them. There's no way of knowing. We do know that some will become violent, and that's what we have to stop. There are no excuses that are good enough to excuse circumcision. The child has his own, let me just say, personal preference, cultural reasons, cultural conditioning, religious bias. It's your religion. Baby isn't born at one religion or another. Let him grow up and decide what religion he wants. And if his God doesn't recognize him with a foreskin, let him decide to cut his off. But don't take it off him because he might want to be Hindu and he wouldn't be allowed to be if you've cut off his foreskin. So he has a right to his own choice of his for his body and for his religion. That's it.
Marilyn, do you have any final reflections you want to share with us before we wrap this up?
Oh, someone showed a TED talk at the last symposium, and it showed about a movement, and it said so they show people enjoying an afternoon on a lawn somewhere, and it's kind of a hillside, and one guy gets up and there's music playing and he starts dancing and he looks like he's just dancing crazy and having a great time, and everybody's looking at him and there's comments, some people are laughing at him and gawking, and then somebody joins him, and so Rebecca, or what the narrator said, so the first person is a leader, but he's not the most important person in the movement. It's the person that comes to follow. Because when you get a follower, now that person starts dancing, and he's looking crazy too, but now there's two of them, and so somebody else joins him. Once you had one follower, then the other follower. When you get the third follower, now you have a movement. Mm-hmm. And that's how it begins. And we have started a movement, and I feel so blessed that in my lifetime, I have initiated a movement, and the followers have come, and I don't know everybody anymore. It's gone way beyond me. Just to be able, and I can say that for my colleagues as well, who were right there with me in the beginning, and we've moved together onward, that we're all feel so blessed to have been on the ground floor of some of social change that means so much, will mean so much in society once we can end this atrocity, this anachronistic blood ritual, and bring about peace and harmony. You know, it will help bring about peace and harmony, I think. And we get to see it in our life, and we know that it's not going to end with us. You know, how many movers and shakers have been able to say, really know that what they did would come to fruition, and we do. So it's such a blessing in a lifetime, you know?
That's a perfect place to end this, Marilyn.
Okay, darling. Well, it's been really fun, Susanna, and I'm honored. I feel honored, and I'm grateful, and thank you.
Oh, thank you so much. But believe me, the honor is all mine, and I just want to wish you the very best in the work that you do. It is so vitally important. Thank you so much.
So there you have it, everyone. That is the end of the two-part interview with Marilyn Milos. If you'd like to see the show notes for this episode, head on over to my website at www.blissrunner.com. There I have links to the various books and other resources that we discussed in this episode, as well as links to Marilyn's website and other information you can find. While you're there, you can pick up a free copy of my Ecstatic Energy Meditation. It's a version of the guided meditation that I use to help kickstart my own ecstatic energy, and I want you to have it for free. Until we meet again, I remain blissfully yours.